I've enjoyed playing here. This has been over 20 years that I've been coming to Royal Melbourne. And this is the way golf should be played.
We love coming down under.
Look, it's phenomenal to play. The quality of the golf's been great. But the enthusiasm of the people has been the thing that's just been amazing.
Tier of courses that I'm willing to shave my neck for in Kingston Heath and Victoria. Get me out of bed to shave.
Especially somewhere like Australia in the sand belt, and I have so many great memories of being down there.
G'day and welcome back to another episode of Australian Golf Passport. I am Scott Warren and I'm joined as always by Matthew Mollica. Hey, Matty.
G'day, Scott. Good to talk with you again.
Yeah, really good to talk with you. There's been a fair bit going on in golf and we're going to get through some of that. And then later in the episode, going to spend some time talking about the Lakes Golf Club in Sydney. But news of the week always comes first, Matty, and you're gonna lead us off on that this week.
We've got a couple of little snippets to get to this week. About an hour prior to recording, I just saw news of the fact that Marvel Stadium down here at Docklands in Melbourne is being transformed into a driving range / golf course / golf experience in the second half of September. So the AFL season's winding down there and finals are taking place at the MCG and a couple of interstate venues. And yeah, the AFL has decided to get one of those in-stadium golf experiences happening at Marvel, September 14 to September 30, by the looks of it, 10 a.m. till 10 p.m. A couple of people will no doubt have seen one or two baseball stadiums in the U.S. in times past turned into golf experiences, and a couple of online influencers hitting short irons off the top deck onto little target greens on the playing surface. So that should be a really neat thing for golfers in Melbourne at that time. Just pencil that into your calendars for something novel and something fun to do in the back half of September.
Yeah, absolutely. I imagine you'll have to jump in and book that pretty soon. Yeah, you're not going to be lobbing up in September and getting a spot I wouldn't have imagined.
Yeah, I'd suspect so. There's a website for inquiries and presumably booking for that, and I'll put that in the show notes so that people can jump onto it straight away.
Excellent.
Those who are much more traditionally minded, the 28th Australian Hickory Shaft Championship has been announced. Golf Society of Australia and the Australian Golf Heritage Society are staging that in a combined fashion. And for 2023, the event is going to be held across both Woodlands and Kingston Heath. There's a foursomes component to it on Sunday, September the 3rd. There's an individual element on Monday the 4th and Tuesday the 5th of September. So round one is at Woodlands, followed by a dinner. And then round two is at Kingston Heath, followed by the presentation. I'll put a link in the show notes for participation in that. A couple of $100 to register and play and attend all of the dinners. I think it might be 400 all told for everything. There's some scope for people to play as singles and attend dinners by themselves or play without going to the dinner. So it's a great way
to play to sandbelt clubs. Yeah, we often have people ask, how can I play sandbelt golf courses? It's a great way to play to sandbelt courses without having a member to host you or whatnot. And if you don't have Hickory clubs, Matty, where are we sending people?
Definitely sending people to Ross Baker at ATT Golf in North Road, Ormond. A couple of people have already visited Ross and made some purchases since hearing about his store that he's opened with Henry Cussell in recent weeks. So thank you to those guys who have ventured out and paid Ross a visit. He's really appreciated seeing you. Hopefully more are able to do the same. But Kingston Heath is an absolute treat with Hickories. It's one of the best courses in the country for it. Dormant Cooch fairways are going to run like Billy O at that time of the year, which is perfect for Hickory play. Those of you who are interstate and wanting to see both Woodlands and Kingston Heath and haven't quite figured out a way, as Scott said, that's your entry point.
Yeah. And if you don't have Hickories, you can duck down to see Ross and Henry and, you know, buy six or seven clubs and you're away. Be good.
Yeah. That's all.
I love the bookends of Hickory Golf at the start of September in Melbourne, and at the end of September you're standing in an indoor football stadium whacking balls onto the playing field. It's nice.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question of you as an accomplished, dedicated hickory golfer?
Yes. I don't know if I'm that accomplished, but anyway.
Why do hickory golfers dress up in period clothing when they play?
I think they just probably go the extra mile in wanting to be true to things of that era. I sometimes do it. I sometimes don't. Very conscious of the fact that I look like a supreme dork when I do it. It sort of feels a bit right to do it with those clubs. Feels a bit wrong if you're wearing clothes of this era but playing stuff of the past.
Yeah, like some Jay Lindeberg or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Plastic techie stuff that it doesn't quite gel.
Maybe the tweed coat stops you over swinging as well. It might actually play a good role in.
It definitely does. You could probably blend the best of both worlds by using the old clubs and just wearing something stylish from Angus and Grace.
There you go.
That's a segue that Adrian Lowe would be proud of, I reckon.
That was a beautiful one. So let's just dive deeper into that segue and mention our very kind sponsor, Angus and Grace Go Golfing. You know the spiel by now. It's Angus and Grace Go Golfing on Instagram. It's angusandgracegogolfing.com. And it's Angus and Grace Go Golfing in real life on William Street in Paddington in Sydney. Really great, beautiful clothing, whether you are male, female, you're a shorts guy like me, you're a trousers guy like Maddie. Outerwear has just come in for this season, and we've told you about the quarter zips that we've been wearing. And I actually was out Monday night in Sydney, was freezing cold. And I was out at a primary school dancer, Stedford, and just went, my wife said, you're going to be something warmer than that? I said, no, it's all good. I've got a T-shirt and I've got the Angus and Grace quarter zip. I'll be fine. And it was a freezing cold night, people in ski jackets, and I just had the Q-zip happening and I was toasty. So big shout out to the Angus and Grace quarter zip. Get in store and try it on, or trust the recommendations of Maddie and myself and order one online. You won't be disappointed.
Definitely not. They've put up an Insta story in the last week or so, I think they've done it. They've got a huge range of some fantastic old clubs in stock at the moment. Golf Daddy visors, some beautiful putters.
Mm. He's got a Titleist Scotty Cameron Terillium from like the one that Tiger won the Masters with in 97.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Matt keeps texting me to try to goad me into buying it off him, and I really want to, but I'm trying to be responsible.
Dad life. Not fair. So yeah, maybe that's a happy medium with the hickories. Don't look like too much of a dork, and yeah, sort of being true to the clubs that you've got in your hand.
There you go.
Might try that. One last little news of the week before we press on to the lakes and the main fair for tonight. I saw on Instagram at the start of the week that construction is officially in full swing on the highly anticipated clubhouse at St. Andrew's Beach, which is
a long time coming.
Not before time. I can tell you that's probably 20 years in the making. So they've started construction. They've cleared space for a car park. I think they are hoping to move into that clubhouse facility for all their golf operations and hospitality and whatnot in early 2024. That's an awesome thing for people that are devotees of that Doak Classic down there on the Mornington Peninsula and want a little bit more of an experience post round with food and drink once they've played there. So congrats to those guys.
I imagine it will boost them in terms of societies and corporate golf and whatnot. You know, those sorts of things that rely on some proper food and beverage before or after the round that you can't really do out of a shipping container or.
Yeah, you know. It's got to. Yeah, got to help them with that. So that rounds us out for news of the week. Scott, those three things.
Excellent. So I've actually got another ad read for you, Maddie. It's a surprise. We were contacted during the week and it was someone that aligned so well with us that I thought I'm going to say yes to this and I'm going to surprise Maddie on air with a new sponsor of Australian Golf Passport.
Okay.
Let me know what you think.
All right. Ready?
the public investment fund of Saudi Arabia is doing exciting things with the game we all love. Your face went from
highly expectant to
went from kind of surprised to excited to deeply unimpressed, like in 3 seconds. That was good fun. And no one else will get to enjoy that, so that was just me just having some fun for my own benefit. But no, of course, a lot's been happening in the world of golf in the last few weeks, and not the sorts of things that we bother ourselves with on this podcast. We read our manifesto out on episode one, and that was certainly part of that. But something that does tie into the topics that we do talk about is the US Open that's just been concluded at LACC, Los Angeles Country Club, which is, of course, a redesign job that was done by Gil Hans, what, about 10, 15 years ago?
More than 15. Yeah.
Right.
It's there's more age to it than I first realized. I visited back in 2012 and it had been done for a couple of years at that stage.
Right.
So
the relevance of Gil Hans's redesign at Los Angeles Country Club is that I got word this week, Maddie, that Royal Sydney Golf Club, who had approval by their members for a Gil Hans redesign back in 2019, have of course gone through a few years of getting their approvals through local council and then the Land and Environment Court, went back with a revised Gil Hans plan to their members that got re-endorsed, and they're full steam ahead on that. Apparently they're going to be poisoning the grass on the course in September this year and then heading into the rebuild of their golf course by Gil Hans and his team. And I think it's not just Gil and Gil that makes this really interesting to me in terms of the comparison. And it's such a great time to have the conversation, I guess, because everyone will be quite familiar with LACC from the US Open coverage. But you've got a course that's on interesting in parts, but also very flat in parts land, similar type of soil. They both are using Cooch and Bermuda grass, both very well-heeled memberships and clubs that can afford to do things right. And of course, you know, Gil Hans on the tools. So it makes me think that, you know, potentially there's some pointers for us in what Gil might produce at Royal Sydney from what he did build at LACC. And I was curious, as someone who's played the LACC course, I haven't, what do you see between the two properties, the two clubs, and potentially the two courses?
I think the land at Los Angeles is more dramatic, and there's that interest to many of the holes down on the flatter part of the property with the Barranca winding through and sitting off to the side of some fairways, cutting across obliquely. And that's... that affords something to LACC that Royal Sydney just doesn't possess. But there are those interesting pockets of topography, and then there's other flatter segments that you sort of got to work some design charm with and really go into the toolbox and create something of great interest from land that's on the flatter side of things. And I think that not only at LACC, but elsewhere, Gil and his crew have demonstrated that they can do that. From the outset, I've been really excited with the possibility of him doing something at Royal Sydney, because I think he's one of the best architects in the world. I loved what he did with that same LACC crew, Jim Wagner, Tommy Naccarato, Jeff Shackelford, when they gave rise to Rustic Canyon, which is a public course outside LA.
I think they've got a track record to Gil and Jim and co of doing a bit bolder and a bit more adventurous, daring work than perhaps Doak or Coran Crenshaw do. I feel like you buy a Doak or Coran Crenshaw course and you sort of know what you're getting. I think Gil does some things that are a little bit left field. His course at Streamsong in Florida, the black course there, has some enormous greens, you know, that are not just, oh, that's a big green, like, oh, that's seven greens in one. So I think it's interesting because the site that Royal Sydney has, it doesn't have some of the features that the Lakes has that we'll get to. It doesn't probably have the spaciousness that the Aussie has. And it certainly doesn't have the location, view or drama of land that New South Wales has. And so for Royal Sydney, that's trying to be, you know, maybe they want to be the best course in Sydney, but probably realistically they're trying to all jockey with the Lakes and the Oz and maybe Bonnie Doon to be the second best in Sydney. What's their competitive advantage against some properties that might have some better canvas than them? And I think it could be just Gill's eye for something different and unexpected. And certainly his routing that he's proposed for Royal Sydney does a great job of, it was always a lament that you were done with the best land at Royal Sydney by the time you walked off sort of the seventh tee.
Mm.
And Gill's found a routing that gets you up to that southeast corner of the property on the front nine and the back nine. So it's, you know, the best golf is going to be drip fed rather than you just, you know, it's over and done in the first hour and a half.
Yeah. And that's what you see at LACC as well. You use some of the dramatic stuff early on, the drop shot, the vertical difference between tee and green on four, that long par three that they play early on is quite substantial. People can appreciate the magnitude of the uphill drives at 12 and 13, the vertical drop on the long par three 11th at LACC. So yeah, there's some rises and falls there both early and late. It would be fantastic if Gill's routing came to fruition and provided that same character to the new course at Royal Sydney.
Yeah.
Their soil's really good, and the sensibility that I think Gill brings to vegetation management is something that will be really valued in his work at Royal Sydney. I'll put some photos up on Insta, courtesy of Joel Stewart, a Californian golfer who gets about and plays a lot of the better courses across that west coast of the US. He's got some comparisons of before and after of LACC North, where the work that Gill's done with tree lines and framing and vistas of many of the holes is fantastic and probably the equal of the architectural improvement. So that would definitely be something that I'd think Royal Sydney members and their guests would look forward to once his work's done.
Yeah. Harley Cruz is also involved at Royal Sydney as the sort of vegetation landscape architect. So supporting what Gill's doing. And I know Harley's doing that job at a couple of courses on the Sandbelt with some great results. So it's probably a good combo.
Yeah, he's got a great familiarity with that understory and low-level vegetation that's indigenous to those specific sites he's working on, both at Rose Bay, the Sandbelt. He's doing something. He was over in Perth recently with Clates as well, looking at Royal Perth from memory. So,
yes. Yeah. And so the redesign of the course itself, we won't spend too much time on Royal Sydney because, of course, the Lakes is the focus here. But it's quite interesting that, you know, the first and the 18th are quite famous holes at Royal Sydney. Gill's plan sort of keeps both of those by and large, same tee and green sites, you know, but the kind of thing that, you know, 18, everyone who knows it would know there's that avenue of high trees down the left of the drive that makes it quite one-dimensional. He pulls those out and puts some interesting bunkers in that corner. So, you know, the sixth hole, which is a little drop shot wedge par three, I think is comfortably the best par three on the course. He's keeping that shot as well. So I think he's done a good job of keeping the things that made Royal Sydney, you know, the good parts of Royal Sydney and made it quite striking and made it memorable, the holes you'd think about on the drive home. But yeah, certainly rerouting to get you up and back into that corner a couple of times will be a great change. So let's move on.
The Lakes, down the road from Royal Sydney. Course that you've played a number of times over the years.
Yeah, I reckon I've played it six or seven times. I'm certainly happy to play it whenever, so Lakes members reach out.
That tendency of your peer clubs across Sydney keeping tee times spare for members at neighbouring clubs. We have course swaps on the Sandbelt down here in Melbourne where there's a designated day where members from one club just flood another another course, and it's not as regular and as consistent as you enjoy up in Sydney. And I really like that. I reckon hopefully our discussion demonstrates that members at Sydney clubs should avail themselves of that chance to go and see the lakes when they can.
Absolutely. Although that tee time swaps that you mentioned are not available to members of the category that I'm in at my club. I mean, I'm desperately trying to get up into that category of membership so I can go and have a look at Royal and the Aussie and the lakes and whatnot. But yeah, it does exist. It does exist. And it's a great feature, you know, as well as obviously recips in other states is the opportunity to go and see those other courses. But so the lakes is part of, you know, and not that we use this as a public term, but, you know, the Sydney Sandbelt, you know, there is that geological feature that pulls through the south of Sydney there. The Aussies built on it. Then obviously the lakes, East Lake and Bonny Doon are all side by side on that. And it is a legitimate pure sand landform that they're built on. At Bonny Doon, it's anywhere between 8 and 16 metres deep of pure sand, and it's more of a beachy sand than you get in Melbourne on the Sandbelt. So the lakes is on that same feature. And those who know the lakes, and you'll see the pictures we put up on Instagram, the big sandy wastes that are one of the real features of the Lakes Golf Club are just exposed what's under the ground. You know, that's what that golf course is built in, which is obviously what made it possible for Clates & Co. to build some of those really wild, interesting greens that are there, you know, just to be able to shape those up like they're playing on the beach.
Hmm. So Ogilvy Clayton did the redo of the lakes back in 2007, I think.
Well, Michael Clayton Golf Design. So Ogilvy Clayton's first job was Bonny Doon, December 2010. So obviously Ogilvy Clayton then gave way to OCCM and then OCM. But no, so the redesign that Clates did was a Michael Clayton Golf Design redesign.
Okay. All right. I'd wondered, and I remember you saying that Bonny Doon was there first. You've said that in a previous episode. Yeah. So, okay. So Clates with a couple of other staff working under his name and in his design firm. Okay.
That's right, yeah.
And harking back to their origins, so the club will celebrate its centenary in a few years' time. They were founded in 1928, or they commenced play in 1928 at that site. And Eric Appley and Tom Howard designed their course, which was interesting. I didn't think that Appley had started plying his trade in golf architecture quite so early, but apparently he had. So,
yeah, I was surprised by that too, and it probably means that I should have done a better job reading the copy of their history book that I own. But there you go.
So they've got a great history. And they've had a couple of design changes and major projects throughout their 95 years, the most obvious of which was the redo as a consequence of the freeway cutting through in the late 60s.
Yeah, that's right.
So that was Devlin and Von Hagee.
It was. And then following that was the redesign that was done by Peter Thompson and his associates, which Clates didn't really leave any of in spirit or in reality when he went through and did his work. Okay. I feel like the lakes is potentially the job that got Mike the real reputation as Chainsaw Mike, because that place was chock-a-block with trees and thick vegetation. And I'll put up, when we put pictures up for this episode, the first hole, which is, you know, this gorgeous angled drive over water to the fairway, little kind of medium length par four, had a big stand of trees right down the edge of the water. If you were standing in the fairway, you could miss the fact that there was that lake there. That real feature piece of the course just really didn't play a part in the first hole because it was hidden behind trees. So you couldn't even hit a ball through the trees into the water. It was quite remarkable. And elsewhere on the course was a similar story. I remember I was a member at Bonnie Doon when Ogilvy Clayton started that work there, and we had a members information night when we were kind of finalising it all, and the members were, you know, one of those times when you give the members the idea that they're able to influence things and that it's not a foregone conclusion, but it's a foregone conclusion. And this elderly fella, and now I was 26 at this point, so maybe he was 55 and I've called him elderly.
Elderly, but yep.
This older bloke, I reckon in my memory, he's, you know, he was 70s or early 80s, and he got up and he got the microphone and he said, Michael, a lot of my good friends are members at the Lakes, and they are just at the end of their wit end with what you've done to that golf course, and I implore you not to do the same thing here. And Clayton's kind of got that little twinkle in his eye and a smile on the corner of his mouth, and he said, what exactly do you mean by that? And the guy said, you've pulled out all the vegetation, and all that you've done, and in the middle of two and three is a perfect example. You've left this sea of sand, and my friends go in there off the tee and they can't advance the ball, and they pick it up, you know, and they're all very unhappy with that. And Clayton's dead eye just stares at this guy, doesn't blink, lifts his microphone and says, well, before I did that work, that area was full of tea trees, so at least now they can find their golf ball. And that was his answer. That was his response. So the famous Clayton's bluntness, but it's true. Like that golf course was hit it down the middle of the fairway. Don't go anywhere near that vegetation because you're going to lose your golf ball, particularly on that front nine on the paddock across Southern Cross Drive from the rest of the clubhouse and the back nine. That was transformed by just opening it up, you know, and it really is remarkable that it's the same course because it doesn't look a damn thing like.
I remember looking out the window while I was driving from the airport to the city when some of that work was going on, and the change was enormous. It was unrecognizable. Yeah. And obviously better, more playable. You're on sand, let's see it. So it's exposed in these ribbons between fairways, and you've got irregular fairway margins, and you don't feel hemmed in when you play. You feel compelled to open your shoulders through that stretch of two, three, and four. You feel like you've got room and space to play.
Yeah. And that perception of space where, you know, sometimes you need to be very precise, but you, like Royal Queensland, it's that you can hit it anywhere. But then you do hit it anywhere and you realize that your angle to the green's terrible and you can't keep it there. So I feel like the Lakes too, it has absolutely like an Australian sense of place in terms of the feeling of the terrain and the vegetation, the way it's presented. But I almost feel like it's an almost American style of architecture with that Australian sense of place. You know, the three par fives on the back nine, obviously all spooning around the water. Some greens that are, you know, pretty wild greens. You know, the likes of the second is a large L-shaped green, you know, and on the back nine, you know, 14's kind of this wave waterfall kind of cascading down the hill towards the lake. There's some really striking stuff there. And I don't say that as a criticism of the lakes. I feel like there's just something American about, to me, some of the design there.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. The 13th, that little par three with the template Woodlands four green, I really love. And I see that as a distinctly Clayton touch and a distinctly Australian feature. But many of the holes, as they sort of spoon around and give you that cape feel that you so often see at Florida courses, finishing holes on the PGA Tour, whether it's Bay Hill or TPC Sawgrass or elsewhere. Yeah, I could definitely see how people would get that feel.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, obviously, the architectural merit of the lakes is extremely high, so it's not, you know, it's not to suggest that it's like your Bay Hill or your Sawgrass 18 where it's quite one-dimensional. But I think, yeah, just in theme, there's something like that. And yeah, it's interesting too that the lakes is, again, we talked earlier, probably the second best course in Sydney, Bonnie Doon might compete for that in some people's eyes. I know after you and I said that in an earlier episode about Bonnie Doon, you know, is it the second best course in Sydney? I had some mates send me texts to just say, like, you're off your head. There's absolutely no way that it's the second best course in Sydney. The Lakes is the second best course in Sydney. And they're probably right. If you look at ranking them and the quality aspect maybe versus the charm and the other things that might pull at the heartstrings. But if it is the second best course in Sydney, it's interesting to me that it's essentially the opposite in every way of the best course in Sydney. Because New South Wales Golf Club, probably its shortcoming is the strategic design of the course in its current format before the Mackenzie and Ebert redesign happens. The Lakes is incredibly strategic. That's its real calling card. Yeah. New South Wales is in the middle of a national park on a headland. The Lakes has one of the busiest roads in Sydney, 6 lanes through the middle of it. You've got planes on approach or departure from Sydney Airport near enough that you feel like if you skied a driver, you could hit them. Homes on that front 9 parcel, pretty close to play on 4 and 5. You know, there's a garden centre behind the 13th hole that's actually being turned into an apartment development. So there's a lot of city around the Lakes. It's not New South Wales, but I think it's good in all the ways New South isn't, in a way, and vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of contrasts. It's a less appealing visual sight for many as well. Like, people love the seclusion and the isolation and the grandeur and the drama of La Perouse. And they'd think, oh, hang on, I've got these lakes scattered around me and going that side of the freeway, and I'm coming back underneath the road again. And I could see how that would lose its appeal for some.
Mm. And like, but 6 lanes at 80 to 100 kilometers an hour is like that does impose on a golf course. The Aussie's a bit the same, you know, with that par 5 in the middle of the back 9 and the holes towards the end of the front 9 that are right up against that road. It does impact. And I think probably it's one of those things like living near a train line where the members probably don't notice it. I think the members would become immune to it. But when you're playing there now and then, it's definitely something.
Yeah, you'd stand on 12T and you'd be looking up that hill, but you'd be conscious of the noise to your left. You'd be thinking, hang on, that freeway's humming.
Yeah.
But I think it's important for everyone who goes to the Lakes, and members will probably be nodding saying, yes, this is what I enjoy about every visit that I make to my club, that hole after hole of really cool strategy and different options on shots depending on how well you're playing and how favourable conditions are. I remember the first time that I visited, and every time since, I've always looked forward to trying to get a good drive away on 11 and at least afford myself the chance of hitting that big hero shot over the water onto the par 5 green in 2.
Mm.
Similar sort of thing at 14, making sure you advance it far enough down there.
Yeah. I invariably have 25 Stableford points because I just, every single shot, you know, the shot into 11, the second into 14, trying to drive it on the 13th. 6, I try and whack it up in the neck and, you know, generally get quick on it and pull it left into the bunkers and make double. Like, there are so many shots that you look forward to hitting. Yeah. And that's one of the things that not a lot of courses, I suppose, have. And maybe there is some overkill and the par 5s, you know, around the water, 3 in 7 holes is a lot. But yeah, I mean, the Lakes has a ton of shots that you just really are thrilling to have a go at.
Yeah, yeah. That's its big appeal for me. Its surfaces, every time I've visited, agronomy's always probably exceeded expectations, which for those fairways is saying something.
Yeah, and worth noting, you know, Australians love to talk about grass. The Lakes, in contrast to the other leading courses in Sydney, is Kaikuyu. Tees, fairways, bet green still. And the Kikuyu, people talk about Riviera in Los Angeles, you know, that hosts the LA Open each year being the best Kikuyu course in the world in terms of the management. I've played Riviera and I've played the lakes a bit, and for me, it's not even close. The way that Anthony Mills and his team prepare the Kikuyu at the lakes and manage it, you know, chemical applications to keep the leaves, you know, thinner and kind of less juicy, less traction on the ball when it lands, allow you to play some of those bump and run type shots that Kikuyu would seem to prevent. They do an incredible job year round. And at this time of year as well is when Lakes members must just feel like they've got something over all the rest of us, because all the Cooch courses are tight and they're dormant and they're starting to get a little bit damp, and the lakes in winter is just as good as it gets. So it's certainly something that sets it apart as well from all those other courses, and they do a spectacular job looking after it.
Yeah, they must have a great deal of know-how, a good budget, lots of experience managing Kikuyu as well, because you can play little bump and runs into 13. You can hit a low runner into that par 3 15th and have it trundle forward, which is sort of what you want to do to many of those pins. And if you'd said to me, oh, you're going to play those shots on a Kikuyu surface, I'd think, oh, it's just not going to work. But it does.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It can, kudos to those guys. They do it really well. The place stands up really, really well to tournament play. They have a great heritage of hosting big events. And we were chatting just before we hit record that they've hosted 7 Australian Opens, as well as a host of other events. There was a Greg Norman Holden International that called the Lakes home for a number of years when I was a younger man, when the Shark was on the prowl. Their catalogue of winners for the Australian Open is very impressive. And I don't want to fall into the category of just reading off a list of good names, because good names played that tournament every year, and that's a given that you're always going to get someone of great standing. But to think that in their 7 stagings of the Australian Open that they've got a list of winners that includes Nicholas, Elkington, Norman, Ogilvy, Peter Senior, Lonard. Chalmers won, as you said. Chalmers won the year in 2011, the year that that Tiger Woods played in the week prior to coming to the President's Cup at Royal Melbourne. And the most recent Aussie Open winner at the Lakes is Abraham Ansah. So they've got a great heritage of hosting events, and that'll continue this year.
That 2011 Aussie Open was also the year that John Daly stormed off the course on 11. Yeah, so he got a 2-stroke penalty on 10 for hitting the wrong ball in a bunker. And then he got to the 11th. He pumped 7 balls into the water, grabbed his son from the gallery and said, we're done, and walked off.
I might, John Jr., I might see if I can find one or two little newspaper archives of that. There's going to be some tin cup references to that, no doubt. So he presumably, I can't remember the specifics of it as well as I'd like, but he presumably has hit a ball that's come off the range. Someone's just cut the ears off it when they were warming up on the practice range and put it onto 10, and he's mistaken his ball for that, or he's mistaken that ball for his ball.
Correct. I'd say that's what's happened. You're right.
Okay.
So that was an eventful one in 2011.
And did he throw a club into the water? Or is he? Is that,
no, just 7 golf balls, I think.
Okay. Because he threw a beautiful Scotty Cameron into the water at Hyatt Regency Coolum, which was fished out the following day, and I think probably still sits proudly in the clubhouse up at Coolum. Okay. Big John. There you go.
I'm also recalling from that 2011, so I spectated that 2011 Aussie Open at the Lakes, and I spent about 3 or 4 hours sitting on the hill behind 13 green watching people play that hole. And it was really interesting because there wasn't just one way that the good players played it. There was, you know, guys driving it, trying to get it on the green. There was driving it left and short of the green and leaving that kind of 30 or 40 yard pitch. There was five and six irons, seven irons up onto the hill to leave a full club in. It was really interesting to see the different approaches that people had. And I'm blanking on his surname now. He was an Aussie pro, Steve something. He had a really prominent monobrow. That's all I can remember. Played in the US for a few years and then lost his game maybe about 6 or 7 years ago.
Steve Bowditch?
Steve Bowditch. There you go. Did a good job of describing him. So he drove it. I think it's gone now, but there was a bunker about 60 yards left and short of the green at that time and drove it in that bunker. So he's hitting a 50, 60 yard bunker shot from left of that green. So he's hitting across the narrow of it. From memory, the pin was towards the back. And I remember saying to my mates, like, this doesn't stay on the green. This shot's impossible. You can't, no one else had hit it there all day. Since you can't keep this on the green. And just to show how good these guys are, he just launched this bunker shot, flew so high, you know, landed 6 feet from the hole and immediately checked up and was just like, those shots that reinforce just how good the best players are and just we're not playing the same game as that.
No. If you're an architect and you thought someone's going to go into that bunker off the tee and you just have in the front of your mind, you think, well, this is death. This is five minimum. You've made a mistake on the drive and you're going to pay for it.
100%.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was a memorable week.
I have a picture in my mind's eye of, and Clates has probably put the photo up once or twice previously on Twitter, of Cam Smith hitting short right and then just hitting a little lob wedge from a good distance on a good line up the length of the green into the slope. And think, okay, that's obviously how it is played in textbook fashion. But it's, I imagine guys could take a lash at it with driver. They could be ultra conservative and hit four iron off that tee and just put something down below. And so your favorite holes, if you were going to give
Before we go into holes, so speaking of the Aussie Open, of course, they're hosting this year with the Australian. So Thursday, Friday across both courses. And then the weekend will be over at the Aussie, which also drove past the Aussie. Usually I'm driving and I'm just looking at the road because I'm going so quick. I went past the other day and I was the passenger and I looked in at the Aussie and I did have a feeling that maybe I've been a bit too hard on the Aussie recently and that I potentially need just to go and have another look and maybe I'll come out and say, no, I was right. But I don't know, driving past, granted, we're moving quick, but I looked down that first hole and I thought, yes, it looks like Florida, but there's probably a bit more to it than that. There's probably a bit more going on maybe than I've given it credit for. And you're staring quite blankly back at me like you disagree and you're quite comfortable with what we've said. I don't know. There's just something about it. I reckon I might head out and watch some of the Aussie Open this year and just, try and have fresh eyes. But yeah, Aussie Open, the Lakes and the Oz for Thursday, Friday, and the Aussie only on the weekend. Again, men and women co-sanctioned, co-competed, though no secondary cut this year, which was extremely unpopular last year down on the Sandbelt. So one cut, and I think to make room for those players, they're having the All Abilities guys finish on Saturday.
Okay. That was certainly, I remember Rod Morrie and a couple of others on the Saturday night expressing some dismay with how things had unfolded and how the Sunday was going to shape up. And I think Rod had a discussion with James Sutherland in the weeks after that event.
Mm-hmm.
So if they've made some little tweaks to the formatting there to allow men, women, and all abilities to play in that event at the same time, but probably improve the way that things were scheduled and maximize the men's and women's fields for the Sunday round, that would be a win. That'd be great.
Yeah.
It would be harking back to your comment a moment ago on the Oz. If you have a mate or any contacts who caddy for pros who are going to participate in that event, I would be really interested to see if they go around with you and what they tell you as you navigate your way through those 18 holes. These are the decisions we make. This is where we want to hit it. If the pin's here, we do this. If the pin's there, we do that. If the wind's out of this direction, our strategy changes accordingly. I'd be really keen to see what they say and how they dissect that course in preparing for an event like the Aussie, because it certainly has a really solid coterie of great fans. And maybe you're right. Maybe there is something that we gloss over and miss when we're distracted by the aesthetic and just rapidly dismiss the course. I know I've been keen to do that.
And it might be something that's worth us doing closer to Aussie Open. Maybe, fresh eyes of the Oz with a guest who doesn't see it the way we see it, and we can go through it and maybe we'll develop an appreciation for some things that we didn't previously have.
Yeah, that's a really good idea.
But so
I'll start thinking about potential third voices for that. So yeah, if we think about the lakes,
Wentworth Avenue to the lakes, yeah.
There's going to be some moments in that 2023 Aussie Open that we see that are exciting and memorable because of the architecture that's there. I was going to ask you about your favourite holes. You talked about drama and strategy. There's going to be a couple of nominees on that list that are really interesting and fun holes to play.
Yeah, I would say let's start with the obvious ones. I think 13-14 is a remarkable stretch because it could yield eagle without much fortune, just well-struck shots. 14 green is a wild green, but it's essentially a series of little pockets. And so if you get it within 15 feet, it's liable to feed to 5 feet. If you get it into the wrong pocket of green, you can have an absolute torture of a putt. Three putts can be a good result, but these guys are really, really good. They're good at hitting straight drives that go a long way, and then they're good at hitting accurate approaches, particularly, it might be a 6 or a 7 iron for those guys to that green. So I think 13-14 is a real highlight part of the course for a reason. The hole that I'll be really interested to see, and it's a hole that I love to play and I love to watch good players play, is right before that, is the 12th. We mentioned that it hugs Southern Cross Drive, so it's not a beautiful hole. It's a long par four that climbs a pretty gradual hill to a green that's set up on top of the dune. And that approach shot, to me, is one of those shots where you can really appreciate a great player versus the rest of us. Even for a good player, it's going to be a longer iron. You need to flight it right depending on the wind. It can leave some really interesting recovery options around that green. That, to me, is a really interesting one as well, I guess, in the context of the tournament when you ask that question, because it's gonna determine the mindset and mood that a player is in when he walks onto, or when she walks onto 13T and starts that stretch towards home. So that, to me, is a really fantastic hole. Likewise, so 18, in the context of finishing holes for big tournaments, a long par three, for me, my memory is that it's always been a hybrid, maybe like a 7 wood, or if it's downwind, you might get away with a 4 iron or something, but it's a long club. And even for the pros, it's going to be where we get enough southerlies in Sydney that there's a good chance they're going to be playing it into or with a quartering wind. And there's not many places now that professional golfers have to hit a long club really precisely under huge pressure. And there's no bigger pressure than the last hole of a National Open. So I'm really keen to see that hole take some scalps, and see someone earn their shots if they can birdie that, or if they can, make a par in tough conditions. I think that those are holes that I find really, really interesting. 9 as well. So par 3s at 9 and 18 at the Lakes. Mm. I love that little ninth green because they've got quite a long teeing ground. So you can trim 30, 40 meters off the hole quite easily. They can tuck pins in that low front left little pocket over, you know, some pretty unappealing land to land short in and have to recover. They can pop it up on, there's kind of a shelf on the back right that's quite exposed and you can easily one hop it into death. So I think they can really play with that hole to make it either a bear or a birdie chance. It's super versatile and a hole that I really enjoy. How about you?
There's a few greens. I think you've probably listed most of the holes that I would as well. I'd add 11 to that just because of the drama of the second shot. It's something that I always look forward to going there. You want to get a good drive away and you want to hit a great approach in there as well. It was interesting listening to your nominations. There's a few greens there that have quite a bit of movement to them.
Yeah.
And you really do need to be precise and make sure that your approach finds that particular part of the green that's pinned. Otherwise, you've got a roller coaster at times. For example, they cut a pin at the front of 14 and you want to play safe and make sure that your approach doesn't get wet, you take an extra club and find the back of the green, you are traversing some dead elephants in that putting surface. Yeah. and putting towards water.
So that 14th green, I've got a theory that, and I've thought about this a lot and I've looked at it when I'm there, wherever the pin is on that 14th green, if you miss short left of the pin, your putt is fine. So any pin on that green, if you're 20, 30 feet short left, totally fine. If you can be 10 feet past them and it's a completely different story. So I think, yeah, you're right. I think for the Aussie Open, obviously the weekend rounds aren't there. There may be some thought around getting the field through on Thursday and Friday and they don't use certain pins. But yeah, I think front left is obviously a place to put a pin if you want to test people out, because the only thing front left is, you know, acres and acres of water.
Yeah. Yeah. If they had a fourth round there with a small field and the pointy end of the field, you'd think they could get in benign conditions, they could get diabolical with some pins on that course.
Yeah. There's that little lobe on the right side of 16.
Yep.
Exactly. And it's only the size of a, like, family dining table.
Yeah. I was going to say a full size billiard table and nothing more. And you just think, I need to have driven it in the right spot and I need to be so precise with this approach.
I just, as I said about that, I remembered this. The last time I played the Lakes was late 2020, I reckon. And so Lucas Michel had just played in the Masters and he was doing his hotel quarantine in Sydney to get back into Australia. And so we thought, well, before you get out of town, let's play some golf. And so Clayt set us up to play at the Lakes. And one of the board members came out with us. You know, obviously Lucas has just played in a major and he wants to play with this guy. And Lucas played like Lucas does. But I played like I do. Anyway, the pin on 16 was front left. And I've just blocked this 6-iron way right. And I've caught that front right lobe. And I was like, oh, geez, that's not great. But I got up there. And so that week I'd been watching a lot of YouTube tutorial type stuff. And it might have been, you know what it was? It was soon after the US Open was at Pebble Beach. And you remember Gary Woodland and Shane Lowry both hit those tight pitches on 17 off the green. And so I'd been reading up on this stuff and chipping with the bounce and all of that. And I thought, bugger it. Like, this is the perfect, I would have had to putt 70 yards or 70 feet right of the hole and it would have been. So I was like, bugger it, I'm going to do this and I can pull it off and I'm not going to damage the green and it's going to be this great little low spinner that, and somewhere between the top of the backswing and impact, I think I just decided this was a really, really, really bad idea and my entire body just shut down. And the leading edge of the 56 went into the behind the ball. The ball popped up and went about 8 feet. And this little toupee of green came out. And I looked up and this board member who was playing with us was just kind of like, It was kind of like your face when I started doing the public investment fund of Saudi Arabia ad read before. He was just kind of like, what just happened? I kind of grabbed the tuft of grain and I stepped it back in. I said, oh, I'm so sorry. And then by that point, the rest of the group was in hysterics and he kind of joined them in hysterics. And I never quite got to be comfortable enough to laugh, but I was like, oh my God. And yeah. Pretty much every time I see Lucas, he's like, oh, how about at the lakes? He has a good thing we weren't playing with anyone on the board or anyone important, wasn't it? That would have been really embarrassing. Yeah. So that, I'll always remember that little lobe of green on the right. And I think it's probably grown back in now. So you shouldn't have to worry. But yeah, that was bad. But that's, again, you would never put it there in a tournament because it would grind the field to a halt. But yeah. It's just a fantastic little thing that for a member club, you know, and you want to challenge a club championship field, love to see it there.
All right. I'm very conscious of time because you have some appointment viewing on TV.
Yes, it's State of Origin number 2 tonight and I'm a long-suffering New South Welshman, so we're probably going to get ours handed to us again, but...
Hopefully not.
I thought the Aussies would lose the first Ashes test overnight as well and we didn't, so maybe lightning can strike twice for me.
Yeah. So those of you who are listening, the State of Origin result will be known and we'll have gone very fast between recording and publishing.
You can send me your commiserations via DM.
And lots of old and new pictures of the lakes, a little bit of their history, a little bit of before and after at LACC, courtesy of Joel Stewart. There'll be some good images to accompany the episode. So get into those.
There's a picture I'm going to put up from the history book, which is a inter-club visit from the Lakes to Huntingdale circa 1960. And Maddie, I'll hold this up to the camera so you can see it now. It's a group of Lakes members.
Oh, jeez.
Dressed. I don't know if it's meant to be Egyptian. I think it's meant to be Egyptian. But there's some sensational 1960 spectacles and pot bellies on display. So that's going to go up. That's going to go up with the rest of the content when we publish.
That might need a not safe for work little sticker on it.
Yeah, Twitter will like be like, "Do you sensitive content? Do you want to see this?
Look away now."
Yeah, so. Unreal.
All right.
Lovely to chat, Maddie.
Likewise. Fun as always, mate.
Thank you. See you, mate.